I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FUNetworkTV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. And now, here's your show.
Now, let's listen.
Hello, Steven.
Hello, Steven. How you doing?
This is one of those times that makes me glad that we are recording in separate places and we're not in the same exact space.
I'm in self-isolation, but not because of the coronavirus, just because no one will talk to me.
Oh, well, okay. And neither of us are, thankfully, infirm, nor are we in our 70s or 80s or older.
No.
So we are going to talk about the coronavirus. As this program continues,
because everyone's talking about it, and so you got to talk about it.
No. A lot of people are talking about it. A lot of people are yelling and screaming and panicking about it. Yes. And I don't wish to downplay the potential danger, but we'll get to that. Yeah. Today's show, we're talking about mostly irrationality in response to various phenomena. Let me put it.
And we're just the people to talk about being irrational.
Because if anyone knows about that, it's two guys named Steven. But the first bit of irrationality I want to talk about is happening in the Democratic Party. Everyone thought that Joe Biden's campaign was pretty much dead, and then it revived with South Carolina, which was always their plan. Anytime, you know, he didn't do well in a previous primary, his people said South Carolina, so it proceeded as they expected, and the other moderates realized, look, there was no path for them to really get to the nomination, so they dropped out and put their support behind Biden because Biden was closest to their views, and also they also feel he is more electable. The Sanders people cried foul again. I mean, Sanders helped write the rules for this, this period of time, and he still is complaining. And you try to engage with a Sanders supporter and say, "Look, it doesn't matter what the polls say now about that he would beat Trump more than Biden would beat Trump." First of all, people should know after the last couple of years that things turn on a dime in politics. I mean, listen, yep. Trudeau was going to coast to victory, and then all of a sudden some pictures came to light. And everyone, you know, the view of him changed radically.
Yep, and 4 years ago, he was in third place and was never going to form a government.
Yeah, that's right.
And then an opposition.
Yeah, and then he formed a majority. So politics is extremely volatile, and you know, even the amazing Kreskin, God bless him, could not really call what's going to happen. But when you try to engage Sanders supporters and say, listen, this is not about whether Bernie Sanders is a nice guy. It's not about whether he has good ideas. It's not about whether his ideas are important and should be implemented in the United States. It's not about any of that. What it's about is the fact that when he has been calling himself a socialist, not lately a democratic socialist, but wow, Americans are really great with nuance, especially during an election. but he's been calling himself a socialist for years. Americans have been fed anti-socialism with their mother's milk for decades, since the end of the Second World War, maybe even before that.
Oh, before that. They just sort of forgot about it for about 4 years while Russia was their ally. And they got right back into it.
Yeah, and there is a real strong undercurrent of people who do not distinguish between democratic socialism or socialism and communism. And Americans, they're preconditioned to react badly to the notion of a socialist as president of the United States. And it doesn't matter what the polls say now, because the polls now can't take into account what the Trump campaign, what the Republican campaigns, and what the super PACs with their unlimited money, the political action committees, the Kremlin are going to do to Bernie Sanders. It'll be another red scare. And he has the largest Achilles heel of any of the candidates because of the fact that he is a socialist. He's not a Democrat. He joined the party out of convenience. I'd have much more respect for the man if he sat as an independent senator and then ran as an independent candidate. Instead, he joins the Democratic Party to use its infrastructure and then whines and complains that he's not treated well and he's not the favorite. Say, well, hey, Bernie, you know, these other people or the people in the party, they've been involved in fundraisers and volunteer work and building up the party for a long time. And you just walked in. Yeah. And
in party politics, we call that paying your dues.
Yeah. And you expect to be treated the same way as people who have built relationships through hard work and dedication to a cause. Yeah, he does expect that. And so do his followers. It's no surprise a lot of his followers are younger. They're politically unsophisticated. They don't really have enough life experience to view the American electorate and American elections through a historical lens. But do you agree with me, Stephen, that it doesn't matter what the polls say now? Once, if Sanders were to be the Democratic candidate, that'd be it. That's four more years of Trump, because they'll just shred him on the socialist thing, especially with his recent comment about Cuba.
Well, I mean, I think the thing that saves Bernie a little bit is exactly what you're pointing out, which is the lack of sophistication among a lot of first-time voters who really don't understand, you know, the nuance and the history and all the rest. His platform, and I said a couple of our podcasts back, I mean, I read through his platform, and if he was a Canadian politician, he would be very, very comfortable in the NDP, and he'd probably even be comfortable in the left wing of the Liberal Party. I mean, the stuff that he proposes, with the exception of maybe, you know, free tuition and forgiving student loans, which is a uniquely American kind of problem. All the rest of his stuff, we look at it, if you go through it as a shopping list as a Canadian voter, you go like, yeah, sure, I support that, I support this, I support, you know, restrictions on gun rights, I support, you know, universal health care. I mean, it's all just sort of mother's milk to Canadians in our kind of, you know, we're not a socialist country by any, you know, a lot.
We're a capitalist country with, Leanna likes to call our social programs capitalist support programs.
Yeah, but they're, you know, it's, we care for people, you know, and if caring for people is socialism, then I guess we're socialists. But, yeah, you know, but on the spectrum, that's not where we are. But, you know, in the American context, I mean, he is a radical, because so many of the things that he stands for, you know, basic human decency, are just anathema to the American mindset, the capital, you know, the raw Yankee trader capitalism that is, you know, really taking hold of the United States, certainly since the Reagan years. And, you know, and now under Trump, just, you know, just on opioids. But I don't know if it's a death knell. But the real wild card to me is whether or not there are enough people who've had it with capitalism. And I'm talking about like the naked greed capitalism of Wall Street, Michael Douglas, as opposed to just sort of a free market system with some reasonable controls. You know, a lot of people are seeing in the United States, with the disparity in the haves and the have-nots, the decline of the middle class, there are a lot of people who are going, you know what, capitalism as we have it right now in the United States is pretty dysfunctional. You know, the 1% keeps getting, you know, 1% becomes the 0.1%, and the, you know, the 99% is becoming, you know, more and more marginalized. I think a lot of people are getting really fed up with it. They're starting to realize that there are serious cracks in that system, and they're not sure exactly how to do it. And a radical solution, you know, as we've seen in times of crisis in other countries and other times, people tend to gravitate towards more radical solutions, because instead of saying, you know, the problem is extreme on the right, so let's go to the extreme on the left, and maybe that'll solve it, instead of saying, you know, maybe somewhere in the middle is not a bad idea. But a lot of people, I think, especially younger people, especially millennials, Gen Xers, Gen Yers,
Xers aren't younger people. I mean, they're I'm a Gen Xer, and I guess, and I'm hardly a younger person.
No, well, you know, a lot of Gen Xers are seeing, you know, retirement in the next 10, 15, 20 years, and they're going like, what am I going to retire on? So they don't really have those cushions that just a few, you know, if you go back just to a slightly older generation, you know, they had stable jobs, they had pensions that came with their stable jobs. You know, they enjoyed a reasonable real estate market. They enjoyed a living wage. You know, those are sorts of things that, you know, the Gen Xers just barely missed. It's almost like it's right out of reach there. They can almost taste it, but they didn't really enjoy it the same way the generation just slightly, you know, half a generation ahead of them did.
The Generation X still was a generation that did better than their parents did. Millennials were the first generation, it's been said, that are not going to do as well as their parents did. I don't think the book is closed on that. And millennials is such a broad term, it's almost absurd, because the older millennials are in their 30s, the younger millennials are in their 20s. There's very, very little in common between them because of the way the world moves so fast nowadays, and you know, what their interests are and what their life experience is. But you know, the problem is that the United States doesn't have capitalism right now. What they've done is they've moved into corporatism. You know, the difference being, if you want a dictionary definition, capitalism, an economic and political system in which a country's trade and industry are controlled by private owners for profit rather than by the state. Corporatism is the control of a state or organization by large interest groups. And that's what the U.S. has, corporatism. And what are the large interest groups? Huge industries, huge businesses. They're the ones that are really calling the shots.
Sure, and those are the industries like the healthcare and insurance industries, which push back so hard against any kind of, you know, forget universal healthcare, just you know, even Obamacare, because there are literally tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars at stake. I mean, there's the oil and gas industry that pushes back against the renewables industry because they get a vested interest in keeping those profits up as well. You know, we've seen the concentration of basic foodstuffs in the hands of a handful of companies, you know, the Monsantos and all the rest, who have actually cornered the market on food. It's amazing just how much aggregation there's been in the corporatist state in the United States. So like you say, a handful of families, a handful of companies control 90% of what's going on, which, you know, is not a free market, clearly.
Yeah. I can understand not just millennials, but everybody being fed up with that. Generation Xers being fed up with that, because you work and you work and you work and you work, and you reach your 50s, and all of a sudden job prospects dry up.
Yeah.
And you don't have that path to retirement that your parents' generation did. And you know, millennials, you know, there was a poll published in 2017 by Pew Research, which said basically millennials don't see it as really essential to live in a democracy anymore. And that's because they were born after the Soviet Union fell apart. They don't really know a world.
They haven't had a taste of the other side.
Yeah, they don't know a polarized, you know, a bipolar world where it was the U.S. Capitalism versus Soviet communism. They don't really even understand, I don't think, the question. And they've got nothing to compare it to. The thing about millennials, though, is that as with every generation, this was true of Generation Xers as well when they were the younger generation, younger voters just turn out in less numbers, in fewer numbers. They're great at knocking on doors for candidates. They're great at getting on social media and campaigning. They're great at being at rallies and screaming. But when it comes to actually voting, they just don't in the same numbers that older cohorts do. So,
and even Sanders was having this problem because in Super Tuesday, he was he didn't do as well as he thought. And one of the questions to him was, posed to him by commentators, was, where are all these young people? You know, you're supposed to have this constituency of young, progressive, disgruntled people who aren't happy with the world the way it is and long for a better world. And they didn't show up. They certainly didn't show up in the numbers that was sort of touted. And it goes to your point, which is, you know, the lack of political engagement, where, you know, it's more than just, you know, posting a funny meme on Facebook or on Twitter. It's actually the work of, and you know, you and I have both done this, knocking on doors, going out, stuffing envelopes, putting things in people's mailboxes, getting on a phone bank and calling people, that real direct human engagement, as opposed to this artificial internet world where it's all great until you actually have to get someone to do something.
Yeah, it's I honestly don't know why that is the case for younger voters. I couldn't wait to be able to vote. I couldn't wait to have that that freedom to cast a ballot to help decide my government. But of course, I'm part of Generation X, and yeah. Generation X, when we were younger, we didn't turn out to vote either. This is not a slag on millennials. Mm-hmm. Every generation that is the younger generation, they just don't turn out to vote in the numbers. They have great political zeal. They have great political idealism, but that idealism doesn't translate into getting their ass into a voting station and casting a ballot. So resting on the strength of the support that you see from younger voters is a very perilous thing to do. Yeah. And
Since older people do come out and vote. I mean, they grew up in a system where voting was important, and they're used to sort of the hands-on political system. Often you'll hear from older voters who will say, like, no one came to my door, and that's a big thing. A lot of people of a younger generation, either they don't have a door you can get to because they're in a condo or something else,
yeah.
Or if someone knocks on your door in the middle of the afternoon, you don't answer it. I mean, there's this social cocooning that has happened.
Well, I imagine that the Ring video doorbell has probably met more canvassers for politicians than actual human beings.
Exactly.
And just talking about Sanders. His plans are really not workable or realistic when you look at the fact that you can't count on the Democrats flipping the Senate. And if the Democrats don't flip the Senate, then these revolutionary plans that he has are going to die. They're not going to get anywhere. He is not going to be able to accomplish the things that they say he's going to accomplish. I have a real problem with them calling him a truth teller. He's the only truth teller out there. When he just started running campaign ads that misrepresented Biden and even Obama, his campaign ads are just as misleading and dishonest as anybody else. Whenever he doesn't win a primary, it's rigged. When he does win, we don't hear that it's rigged. Or if he does win, but not by a high enough margin, then it's rigged. There's just this sore loser attitude amongst, and this is not amongst all Bernie supporters, but I'm talking about the ardent Bernie foaming at the mouth. If it's not Bernie, I'll vote for Trump or I won't vote. Those people who are, and let's face it. If you say that you are a Democrat, a Democratic Socialist, and if Bernie is not the candidate for the Democrats, you won't vote for him. You are not a Democratic Socialist. You are a Bernie acolyte, because no Democratic Socialist would ever do anything that would somehow help Trump stay in power for another 4 years and continue to build those oligarchies amongst his friends. There's this cult of personality around Bernie Sanders, so that you can't really have a rational discussion, certainly not on the internet, because if you say, look, based on the way Hillary's emails, which was a nothing burger, got turned into something huge, and how much Trump used that, just think of what he'll do with the fact that there's a candidate who calls himself a socialist, and Americans are afraid of socialism. And the amount of that his plans would cost would add so much to the deficit. Their debt to GDP ratio in the United States is absurd already. It's got to be about three, four, five times what Canada's is.
Yep, it is.
And Americans do deserve better healthcare. It's what they have there is barbaric for a first world nation. But Americans are also, they're in business, they're great cotton to a new idea. There's no questioning that when I deal with Americans for business, they understand business. Whereas in Canada, it's a lot of monkey business. But when it comes to actual change, when it comes to really being progressive, moving forward, being bold, they're not so good at that. They like things in baby steps. You know, you think about how much they fought against Obamacare. And then once they got Obamacare, they didn't want anyone taking it away from them. But that was a baby step. That was a, you had to introduce that slowly, because America is not, especially now, they don't want a revolution. They just had one. They went all in with Trump, the ones that did, and made him president and said, you know, he's completely different and he's going to change the system and he's going to go to Washington and he's going to shake it up. And he did, but he didn't. But not all shakeups are good. And I think Americans want right now, before they're willing to make a jump to something that is super progressive, they want a period of stability. They need they need to take a nap in between. They need somebody to restore government to what it was, you know, co-equal branches of government that answer subpoenas and that aren't constantly in the news for caging children and things of that nature. You know, they want somebody who is familiar, who is comfortable, and who is not preaching revolution. They want somebody like Joe Biden.
Yeah, they want someone boring, because boring is comfortable. Yep. And there are no surprises. And especially if you've been through a turbulent time, you know, in the Trump years have certainly been a turbulent time. You want someone who is just going to let you catch your breath and not do anything too crazy. And that may be, you know, there are all kinds of ills in the United States. There's all kinds of ills in Canada as well. You know, lots of things that need to be done. A lot of things we can do better. But, you know, people aren't necessarily looking for someone to come in and fix everything all at once. And a radical program, you know, when you start throwing around the word revolution, you know, they start thinking about Central American revolutions or Russian revolutions. I mean, that's not the word that makes a lot of voters comfortable. Even though if you go through,
America was formed on a revolution.
Well, exactly.
But that was a long time ago.
No, that was the only good revolution. There aren't any other good. That was the only good one.
And you know what? If you look at a lot of revolutions in the world since the American Revolution,
they're pretty much right. Maybe the French Revolution, you know, it started.
Yeah, followed by
stuff,
the Terror.
But it ended up pretty terrible. And, you know, the Russian Revolution, it freed a lot of people, but then it became pretty terrible. And China, so the word revolution is a packed one. And the thing about Sanders is it's really interesting. You know, they talk about him being consistent, that he has been... He's been talking the same message for 30, 40 years.
Same message. It's the same speech every single time he talks.
Exactly. And some people say, well, look, he's consistent. That's a good thing. I mean, he stands by his values and you know, it's like, well, I don't trust someone who doesn't evolve a little bit. I mean, very few of us get it right the first time. It's like, you know, when we're 18 or 20 years old and we've figured out the world and that's the way the world is, and we never have to change anything in our viewpoint because we've really pegged it. It's like, you know, most of us, we learn more about the nuances, we learn a little bit more about what's really happening, and you start to go, you know, the world is not quite as black and white as I thought it was in my 20s. It's now an awful lot of shades of gray, and I'm not even sure, some of the more basic things that I believed are necessarily are not necessarily absolutes either. And when Bernie says, you know, this is the way it is, this, you know, and like you said, the same speech, it doesn't show a lot of growth. I mean, and again, Bernie supporters say, well, it's because he got it right. I mean, why would you change if you got the right message? And it's like, well, I'm not quite sure that this is, this.
Well, it's like you said,
ideological, dogmatic. Yeah. It's inflexible, and I think a lot of people are very uncomfortable with something that's as inflexible as Bernie is. Even if a lot of his policies individually, a lot of this is labeling. If you took the socialist label off of it, you took away the revolutionary, and you put it in a different person. You didn't put it in Bernie. You put it in some boring, 50-year-old white guy, and they started talking about some of the things about, women should be treated more equally, and, we should have more respect for this, and, guns are a real problem. We should do something about a lot of the
well, Bernie's got a bad record on gun votes, but...
Yeah, well, he kind of, he's kind of flipped around a little bit on those, but it's the kind of thing where if you put Bernie's message, toned it down a little bit, and put it in a different package using a little different language, it could be incredibly popular. But you know, the way he presents it sometimes is it's strident, it's dogmatic, it's ideological, it's laden with the language of the left, which turns people off. I mean, I'm talking about practical politics here. I'm not making value judgments one way or the other about his platform. I'm just talking about on an electability level. Not the world as it should be, but the world as it is.
That's the crux of it, though.
Yeah,
is that a lot of Bernie supporters are talking about the world as it should be, and they think when you say, "Well, look, Bernie's not electable this time around," they say that, "Oh, then you're happy with all these millions of Americans being uninsured. You're happy with children going hungry." No, what I'm saying is, in practical terms, he's not electable, so none of those reforms are going to happen. And it's also, I mean, I have a problem also with Sanders as this truth teller when he's 78 years old, just had a heart attack, and won't release his health records.
Yeah.
That's not a truth teller. That's a Trump-like move. And I think Americans are sick of hearing angry old men yelling at them. And to
to be lectured.
Yeah. Further to your point, though, I wish I had this at my fingertips. I don't. People can Google it. There was a poll taken where people, I think more than one, where people, where pollsters would speak to people and they would lay out Bernie policies. They would just not say who they were attached to. They would say, "Do you support the idea of single payer healthcare? Do you support the idea of free college tuition and forgiveness of debt, whatever?" And a majority of people said yes. And then when they called it socialism, and they said, they said that these are socialist plans or could be called socialist, do you still support them? The support dropped. And then when they said, "These are Bernie Sanders policies, how do you feel now?" Support dropped even more. So there really isn't that much support when it comes down to it for Bernie Sanders, because he's got so many negatives. I mean, if you look at the negative ratings on candidates, he's got huge negatives. And listen, I've never liked Joe Biden. I didn't want him to enter this race. I don't like Joe Biden. I think that he's largely full of shit in many ways. I think he takes a lot of credit for things that happened in the Obama administration. That
he's got a lot of baggage.
He didn't do, and you know what? He has, in fairness, he has a lot of baggage because the man's been in politics. Oh, because
he's been around a long time. Exactly.
And the world has changed substantially during the time he has been in office.
Yeah.
And I do not like, as I've stated before, somebody or anybody or any crowd blaming one individual for acting in a way that everybody acted when certain things were normalized in the past that no longer are. Mm-hmm. You can't hold one person accountable for the way the world was back then. And he does have baggage, but nowhere near the baggage that Trump has. And what's very upsetting is the number of Bernie supporters who are on the internet now spreading this notion that Joe Biden has dementia. And they keep making jokes about how he doesn't even know what day it is. It's like, what kind of America do you want? Do you want 4 more years of Trump? Is that what it is? And that's what makes me wonder, what is your ultimate goal if your goal is at least some form of humane governance, which is not what Trump is offering, then you should be supporting grudgingly, if necessary, holding your nose if necessary, you should be supporting the Democratic candidate. You look at what Republicans do, or even in Canada, what conservatives do. They'll have some horrible leaders. Conservatives hated Andrew Scheer. The number of conservatives, diehard conservatives I spoke to who hated Andrew Scheer, they hated Andrew Scheer. They didn't go out in public and say so.
Yep.
Conservatives line up behind the leader. They don't show the cracks. They don't show the internecine fighting. Whereas on the left, the internecine fighting is highlighted and becomes a battle on one side of the aisle, while the other side of the aisle has their ducks in a row.
Yeah. And especially on the left. I mean, the left has been really good in this country, and we're seeing it in the States too, in the purity tests, in attacking, you know, the greatest enemy isn't the other party. It isn't, you know, if you're a Democrat, it's not the Republicans, it's the other Democrats. Or if you're a Sanders, it's your Democratic cohort, or, you know, the Democratic elite, as he likes to say. They're, you know, those are the enemies, because, and this, again, this is very much a left thing, because the left isn't particularly coherent. It's fragmented, and they're always jockeying for position on the left, and they consider, you know, people who do not follow, you know, in the extreme examples. I mean, you know, if you go way out to the left, you've got, the Trotskyites and the Marxist-Leninists and all the rest. And they just basically spend all their time slagging each other. They don't ever try to, fight the other, they don't fight conservatives. The real enemy is each other. And that, this is a real problem. You know, the right is, like you said, they keep their fights inside the tent until they finally say, okay, that's it. We're the sheer guy's out. And then it all comes out. But up until that point, you see a lot of solidarity, but you don't see that same solidarity in the left. And Bernie is very, and the Bernie bros are very much like that, because their enemy are the other Democrats. I mean, they hated Elizabeth Warren more than they hated Trump. They, they certainly hate Biden a lot more than they hate Trump.
They hated Buttigieg, even though because he posed a threat.
Because those people are traitors to the left is the problem. And, you hate a traitor more than you hate a real enemy.
Yeah, and they're traitors because they're practical in their solutions.
Well,
they really want to get things done, as opposed to let's put all of our eggs in this one basket and hope that we can get this through. When it's history tells you, and even current history and current trends tell you, that basket of eggs is going to get crushed.
And there's no compromise either. I mean, if you because and this is the other thing about Sanders. I mean, he hasn't had to compromise because he's an independent. He doesn't have anyone to compromise with. He just has his own following, his own voters, his own conscience, and so he doesn't have to change his ideas, because he's not trying to broker a deal with anybody. He's not trying to actually wield power and come to something, a win-win situation with someone whose interests are different than his. He sits as an independent in between presidential campaigns, and, he doesn't have a caucus that he has to, barter with. No, too much bartering, too much wheeling and dealing. That's a bad thing in democracy too. But you can't have this rigidity that Sanders had and expect to have a broad base of support.
No, and they do expect that they're owed a broad
base
of support, because Bernie's right. And you know what? The things that he's saying aren't wrong in many ways. Americans should move to a single-payer healthcare system. There's no question. But you can't do it in one jump. Americans... I'm torn on the idea of forgiving college debt for the same reason that Buttigieg was, which is, okay, what happens to the next generation or the next, you forgive college debt from this point forward or backwards. The next generation or the next people that come up next year that get debt, what happens to their debt? Now they're responsible for debt, and everybody else's was forgiven. Also, free college means that college degrees become less valuable. Just like, it used to be you could get a job with a high school diploma, because not everybody had high school diplomas. Many people quit high school and went to work and so on. So a high school diploma being more rare showed that you had more stick-to-itiveness, that more dedication, more education, more discipline, and so you got a job. Then, as more people got high school diplomas, that became less worthwhile as far as, employers looking for people, to take their jobs. Mm-hmm. And they demanded some kind of university degree, kind of BA, even if it was bullshit, some kind of, I know somebody who got a BA in rhetoric, but he's still...
Don't argue with them.
But yeah. He's got a BA.
Sure.
And if everybody has... if there's free college and everybody gets a college degree, then employers are going to move to demanding people have masters, like post grad.
They're going to have to actually hire qualified people, not just based on paper.
Yeah, well, they're going to demand that people have a postgraduate degree. It's not going to make it so much easier for yeah. people. I mean, it'll make it easier for some people, but it won't make it easier in general. It's just going to change the bar. It's not going to make it so that everybody has the same advantages. No, that's not how the system works. And really, Bernie bros or Bernie brats or Bernie babies, whichever hashtag you want to use, should not be going on the internet and making comments about, spreading comments about Biden being, in dementia, because mm-hmm. they're doing Trump's work for him.
Yeah.
It's like,
well, Democrats are great at shooting themselves in the foot.
Like, I understand being dedicated and wanting a candidate to win. I get that. I understand really identifying with their ideals and wanting to see those carry the day. I get that. But what I don't understand is when that candidate doesn't succeed, isn't the person to become the actual candidate for the Democratic Party or whichever party, you know, we're talking about, why would you then go and sabotage the candidate who it was successful on, who was running on the same side as the person that you were supporting? Just because you don't get 100% of something, you're willing to take nothing.
Yeah, well, and especially in a system where, you know, there's nomination process, you know, the Americans got this weird hybrid nomination process of caucuses and primaries. But, you know, when you go after, you know, and he's, you know, Sanders is finding this now, when you go after Elizabeth Warren or Bloomberg or Pete Buttigieg, you are alienating their delegates who at some point, you may want their vote. So if you go on and, you know, you have, who was it? Sanders had to fire a regional field director in Michigan over his private Twitter account, where he was insulting the other candidates, their families, you know, cruel commentaries on their sexuality and physical appearance. I mean, what political gain is there for you if you're doing that inside your party and alienating the very people whose votes you're going to need at some point at a convention? It just, you know, those people either, you know, okay, rally behind me now. It's like, wait a second. I put my heart and soul into the Elizabeth Warren campaign or the Pete Buttigieg campaign. And you started making homophobic remarks about Mayor Pete, or you're making misogynistic comments about Elizabeth Warren. And now, you're saying, okay, Democrats, it's time to come together. Come, you know, line up behind me. It's like, oh, screw you. I'm not doing that. And, that's just party politics.
Yeah. And they just seem angry. And again, separating Bernie supporters from the Bernie bros, and that's a unisex term. We're not talking about people who support him, but you know, if he doesn't win, they recognize it's a contest and there's a winner and there are losers and he didn't carry the day, they'll still vote Democrat. It's the people who are saying it's Bernie or nothing, which doesn't make any sense, that they would rather have Trump for four more years than have a Democrat who, while not as left-wing and not promising as many rainbows and unicorns, will still govern in a way that won't enrage you on a daily basis, probably won't cage children at the border, won't, you know, the list goes on. Just because you can't get, like, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good or the all right in this case. And that's the thing that's disturbing, is I don't really believe these people are Democrats, just the same way I don't believe that Trumpites are Republicans.
No, it is a personal, you know, it's a personal, you know, attachment that they have to the leader. You know, people call it the cult of personality, and I think it, the alliance is to the person, not to the party, and not necessarily even, you know, to some of the ideas either. You know, there was a book that I found really influential. It was written in the 50s, I think, by a guy named Eric Hoffer, and it was called The True Believer. And it's a little skinny book, if you can find it. It must be on, you know, secondhand bookstores all over the place. It's a really fast read. It's like 100 pages. But it's a psychological profile of people who are fanatics, people who believe things with such a passion that they lose themselves in it. And it's a really interesting study, and it goes across religions and political spectrums. And it's the kind of person who needs to throw their heart and soul into believing in a person, a cause, or something. And, you know, the psychology about being able to sort of tailor all the facts to fit it, to fit their beliefs, and to be able to alienate everything that, you know, doesn't fit your narrative, and how these people also will flip from being, you know, incredibly active atheists, you know, militant atheists, and will have a conversion to Catholicism and become an incredibly devout right-wing Catholic. And it's the same person, but it's the same psychology and the same thing. You know, they saw it in the 20s and 30s in Germany, you know, communists, you know, hardcore communist members, you know, street fighters and all the rest, the toughest of the tough, who were brawling with the Nazis, a lot of them became Hitler fans. And they just gave up all of the communist stuff and they just followed because, and they go like, well, ideologically, that doesn't make any sense at all. But it isn't about ideology. It's about the need to believe and finding something that you can throw yourself and lose yourself in. And I think, you know, the Bernie Bros on the hardest, you know, extent of it, with a small cadre of, it's a strange subculture of sort of socialist frat boys. That just doesn't sort of gel with me, but they are really passionate about Bernie. And you know, they were probably passionate about something else before Bernie came along as well, but there's just no,
or they were looking for something to be passionate about. Yeah. And this is the first thing.
And, well, and it gives like their purpose to their lives and meaning. And yeah, exactly. And they feel it incredibly deeply. And their entire personality is sort of tied up into it. Like you say, until, you know, if Bernie flames out or drop dead tomorrow or something, their personality type is they would grab something else, the same way the Trump supporters are like that. I mean, and that sort of explains also why, you know, you say, well, you know, if Bernie in the last election, they say, well, Bernie's out now because, you know, the DNC, you know, screwed him out of the nomination and that wicked Hillary. So I guess I'm going to vote for Trump now. It's like, wait a second. That doesn't make any sense.
Were you voting for a certain set of values?
Yeah. And apparently
or
not.
Were you voting for a person?
Yeah, they're voting for a personality, a strong personality that they can either identify with or lose themselves in, and makes it easy for them. It gives them Eric Hoffer is the book, The True Believer. I really recommend it to anyone who wants a little fast.
I have to pick that up myself too. It's probably available on Amazon.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Yeah, so you don't have to try to find a secondhand bookstore because they're rarer than hen's teeth.
Really good writer, and it really makes you think about sort of the psychology of fanaticism.
And make no mistake, if Sanders does win the candidacy, and he is the Democratic candidate for president, I will root for him. I will,
absolutely.
I will back him. I will root for him. I will put up tweets supporting him. I will not be mentioning his negatives. I'll be doing everything possible to see that he overcomes the Achilles heel that he has. And
he's way better than Trump and the way America's
exactly
going.
I would totally, if Sanders winds up being the guy who is the Democratic candidate, 100% I'm behind him, because I want a Democrat and I want Trump out. And I don't understand Bernie supporters who don't say the same thing. Like if Biden is the candidate, I'm going to support him. Instead, they're going on and making comments about how he can't remember his name and doesn't know what day it is. And they may as well, you know, be working for Trump's team at that point in time. They're spreading that thing around, making it, the kind of thing that's no longer whispered but spoken aloud, and not only by partisans for Trump, which people, you know, swing voters can dismiss, but when you start hearing Democrats saying it, it affects swing voters and the undecideds. And it's a very sad picture of human nature, what we're seeing now, both on the right and on the left, that they're gravitating to these polarizing, loud, yelling, inflexible figures, and refusing to accept that true progress, most of the time, not always, but most of the time, true progress is achieved one foot in front of the other, not through giant leaps over chasms. And that's irrational to believe that somebody can come to Washington and change everything. And just as irrational has been the response of primarily Americans, some Canadians, to the coronavirus outbreak. Don't you think that it's seriously affected our economy? And what's affected our economy? Well, we can't get goods from China because China is quarantined and so on. But people also aren't going out. They're not going out to restaurants. They're not going out to malls. They're not buying things. And it's because of panic. And while there's reason to be concerned, the level of deaths that have occurred so far doesn't really qualify the level of panic that has. I mean, I saw pictures of people at Walmart fighting over hoarding toilet paper.
Yeah. Which is odd because, you know, this isn't a disease that makes you
that
go to the bathroom a lot.
Yeah, you should be hoarding Kleenex.
Yes.
But it's, once again, we're seeing this irration. I mean, Americans love nothing more than fear.
Yep, this mass hysteria.
Yeah.
Well, it gives purpose to your life. It's, it's exciting. It's everyone loves to, think that they're in The Walking Dead or I Am Legend or Omega Man or something. It's, this is it. This is why I've been stockpiling all those baked beans and my guns.
We've had other viruses.
We have them in regularly.
The past, yeah. I mean, the H1N1. 2009 is when it came out.
Yeah, we had SARS 2004, was it? I think.
Yep, 2003, 2004. The Center for Disease Control in the United States estimates that between 152,000 and 576,000 people died worldwide from H1N1.
Yeah.
That's a massive gap. Clearly, there's missing data. They don't know because these things tend to affect people who are older, mm-hmm. and you don't know if their death was natural or it was because of H1N1.
Or it was just a regular cold or flu or something
else. Yeah, you don't know.
There's lots of things you can die from.
Yeah, there's a lot of Reaper's little helpers out there. But 150,000 to 575,000. That's a pretty big range worldwide. And a lot of those deaths, of course, occur in third world countries and in other countries where there isn't access to healthcare.
Yeah. And there's also, poor nutrition, and there's, just generally your life is a lot crappier. And so you're much more vulnerable to these sorts of things, not to mention, like you said, not as much access to first world healthcare. But, that's also true for a lot of the United States.
Yeah. And the H1N1 pandemic in the US specifically, there were almost 61 million cases. There was 274,000 hospitalizations, I don't mean to downplay this, but only 12,469 deaths.
Yeah.
When you look at the ratios of the fatality versus the number of people who were hospitalized, the survival rate was all right. And SARS, we got hit really heavily here.
Yeah, Canada was one of the epicenters of it.
Yeah, but the National Health Service in the United States, in the UK, found that there was 8,000 cases reported and 774 deaths. That's an actually higher proportion of deaths. And yet, the world, SARS passed, the world continued. H1N1 passed, the world continued. This is not the end of the world the way people are making it. Yes, the coronavirus is something that is scary because of the fact that it's airborne.
It's really easily transmissible. There was something someone was saying the other day, something to keep in mind about, everyone goes on about the mortality. Is it more deadly? Is it less deadly than the flu or all these other things? And the thing is, we really don't know because I think I saw a figure today that the United States has only tested 6,000 people so far for it. That's how many tests they've administered. And just because they don't have enough test kits, because it's a new virus and it's limited supply. So there's all these people who you don't even know if they don't even know if they've had it necessarily. They may have had it, thought it was a cold, felt crappy for a couple of days, got over it. Or they sat around going, boy, I think I've got COVID-19. They pass through and they've never had a test, so they don't actually come into the figures. So you can't tell what the mortality is until you know how big the population that has it is. And we don't know how big the population that has it is.
No. And people will get the coronavirus and they'll feel crappy for a few days, 2 weeks, and then they'll get better. Most people will get better. the people that have to be concerned are those who are in poor health.
Yeah, over already. 70.
Yeah, yeah.
70 and have respiratory problems.
Yeah, and that's scary. I mean, my wife's not over 70, but she has terrible asthma. She has respiratory problems. So it's a concern. But she's got a robust, system so that she can fight it. People will die from this, mostly older people. And you know what? People see that as, well, that's the way of life. Older people die. Some will die that shouldn't have died so soon as a result of this. But this lockdown on our economies, because people are afraid to go out of their homes.
Oh, you know, meetings are being canceled all over the place. I mean, forget the cruise lines. You know, airplanes are traveling empty.
Well, conventions aren't happening. Yeah. You know, so many things are not happening. And they're talking about, you know, they're looking now at conventions a month from now, 2 months from now, and wondering whether they're going to even happen. Yeah. Apparently NBA team owners told their players, don't be surprised if you go out there and you're playing
to
very few people, because people are afraid to gather. And it's a panic. Wash your hands. And if you're feeling sick, stay home. The problem, of course, is that in the US and in Canada, a lot of people don't get a whole lot of paid sick days. Yep. Some people get no paid sick days, mm-hmm. and so they can't afford to stay home for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
They won't be able to pay their rent. They won't be able to have food,
or they won't have a job to come back to because they'll be fired.
Yeah, and personally, I think any workplace that sees somebody is sick should say, for the good of the rest of this workplace and for the productivity of the rest of the people in this workplace, we're going to send you home and we're going to pay you as if you were here, you know, because otherwise we could, you know, you being here could take out the whole department and our productivity drops to zero. You're better off losing a couple of people for a couple of weeks and paying the freight for them being at home than you are losing
the entire
department.
Business. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, and that's a scary aspect of it, is the number of people who are going out and spreading it, because they may have symptoms, but they simply can't afford to stay home and ride it out.
Yeah. And, and they say that social distance is a big factor as well. One of the things about Canada and Canadians is we are generally big believers in social distance. We don't except for close friends, you know, who you shake hands and hugs with. You know, generally we like to have a little bubble of space around us.
Yeah.
It's just part of our culture that it's a big country, so we're used to having lots of space, even in the cities where we have lots of parks and all the rest. And everyone complains, you know, that people drive cars and you get on the highway and there's lots of single passenger cars. But you know, during a pandemic, that's a good thing, because you're not packed into transit. And it's no accident, I think, that some of the biggest hotspots for COVID-19 have been in countries where there is a lot less social distance. You know, China, I spent a lot of time in China. You go to Hong Kong, you go to Beijing, you go to some of the big cities, you're packed in there pretty close. You are rubbing up against people all the time.
Yeah.
And there just isn't that same sense of, you know, you need to be 3 feet away from me because it's a crowded country. Oddly, you know, Italy, same sort of thing. You know, not as much social distance in Italy, and you know, they've basically closed down Italy at this point. And oddly enough, even Switzerland. You know, Switzerland is one of the hot spots for COVID-19. And I was talking to a friend of mine who is Swiss, and he says, "Well, it's because we have we've abandoned the car in all of our city centers. Anyway, it makes a great livable city. You know, everyone walks and bikes and all the rest, but they have a ton of transit and everyone kind of gets on, you know, packs into the transit. You know, Zurich is, you know, it's a pretty city, but people tend to be, it's a small city with a lot of people in it. And those are the vectors. That's how the disease gets transmitted. So it's not surprising that you see them in all these places. Interestingly enough, Italy was the first point of contact in Europe for the Black Death from the Great Plague in 1347. I actually wrote a paper on the Black Death, and I never thought it would actually be a useful conversation thing. But, you know, it came in through Genoa and did like three circuits of Europe between 1347 and 1351 and killed between 30% to 60% of the population. Now, that's a mortality rate.
Well, the
kill half the people in
Spanish
Europe.
Flu It killed, I think, millions.
Oh, yeah.
The swine flu also was, you know, we've been through these things before.
Yeah.
And we pick up. I mean, Italy is now quarantined. All of Italy is basically... Yep.
If you're in, you're not getting
a country is quarantined.
Yeah, and they've said no gatherings, no church services, no. Even the Vatican had to shut down. They said getting out into in front of St. Peter's Cathedral and getting the blessing of the Pope, and people would pack in there. The Italian government, even though the Vatican City is a sovereign state, said you can't do that anymore. And the Vatican finally said, yeah, I guess not.
I hope that they say that it's going to be quite a while till they're able to come up with
generally what happens is a virus will run through a community. I mean, it's really hard in this time of air travel, where people can get on a plane and be in a different continent in a couple of hours, to keep a disease from moving, especially one that's asymptomatic in the first stages. You just have no idea who is where, and you can't lock down a world anymore. So the whole idea is, the virus runs its course. You try to protect the most vulnerable and wash your hands. For God's sakes, wash your hands. You should have been washing your hands before this thing, but definitely do it now. And eventually, like the flu virus, the reason that we have a different flu shot every year is because viruses mutate. And that's what, that's what happened to the plague. The Black Death mutated three times. It came out as the bubonic plague, which killed you in 5 days. Then it mutated into the pneumonic plague, so it was airborne. It would kill you in 2 days. And then it became the septicemic plague, and it would kill you in 12 hours. And then it just burned itself out because it killed off the hosts, or it mutated into something that we were now resistant to the next time around, and it disappeared. And it disappeared for 100, well, actually there still are examples of the plague. India still has a couple dozen cases of the plague every year. Now we treat it with antibiotics and all the rest. And that's a bacterial infection, not a viral infection.
Right.
But these things mutate, and that's sort of killing off its host is not a good way for a virus to survive. So eventually it just sort of peters out. So if we don't have a way to protect ourselves with an antiviral, if you have a vaccine, that's great, but it's probably not going to be a year and a half before we have a vaccine. So in the meantime, wash your hands.
Yeah. And you're right. It will burn through communities. The most vulnerable will die.
Yeah. Because where is the H1N1 now? Or where is
SARS?
They come and go.
Yeah. They come and go. And this, I hope, will follow that pattern as well. We don't know. I don't want to make light of it and say, it's nothing, like President Trump. Yes, it is something to be concerned about, but there is a line between concern and panic.
Absolutely.
And what we're seeing now is panic, and that is actually exacerbating other problems for people, economic problems for people, because you think about the coffee shops that people aren't going to. Well, the staff who are working hourly and for tips, who rely on that, get told, don't come in today. There's not enough business. It hurts them. They can't afford the necessities of life. And so this is having a domino effect, and the domino effect is being caused not so much by the disease, but by people's perception of the illness and by the panic that has arisen as a result of it. And I think it's because we're not, we don't know enough about it. And so people who think they know are filling in blanks that they shouldn't be filling in, because in fact they are blanks.
Oh, and I see people online who are like, here's how to make your own hand sanitizer out of essential oils and stuff. It's like, oh, come on, people.
Yeah, those are essential oil manufacturers.
You're dead, but you smell like patchouli. Yeah.
I think that's a great place to leave it. It's always good to leave on a laugh, even though we talk about serious things.
Hopefully we're both back here next week.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, listen, neither of us are terribly
I never leave my couch. I'm in self-isolation already, so it doesn't matter.
That's
I live a lonely life.
Listen, I don't live a lonely life. I just avoid people. we will be back again next week with Stephen and Stephen. You can find my friend Stephen Lawton on Twitter. It's at Stephen Lawtons, and it's Stephen with the PH, and it's LAUTENS. And you can find me at Stephen J. Kersner. I'm Stephen of the V variety. Once again, I will promise to check that Twitter account, and I still haven't. This is like week show four, I think, probably. I promised I would do it, and
you're never going to do it.
I absolutely have to. I've been very, very busy.
Twitter misses busy. You. Oh, Twitter would be a much better place with you in it.
Well, thank you very much.
Couldn't be any worse.
Yeah, you're probably right. I think my life is better without me being on Twitter.
Well, that's probably true.
But that's a topic for another day. Thank you, Stephen. And thank
Always
you all
a pleasure.
For listening. And thank you for making this show as successful as it's been. We're on the FU Politics channel, and we're perpetually in the top 10. The series on sometimes two of our episodes are in the top 10. But they're thank you for embracing the show. Because the world needs to,
but use Purell after you embrace the show, because you never know where we've been.
Yeah, the world needs a show, where two middle aged white guys talk about their opinions of the world, because
there aren't enough white people giving opinions.
There's just not enough of those programs out there.
You ruined it.
Don't forget to support us on patreon.com/FUNetworkTV, or give us a one-time donation at PayPal through our email address FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. He is Stephen Lawtons. I am Stephen Kersner, and we both thank you for listening, and we'll be back again next episode.
This is fun! The FU Network!